MacCast, Sunday, April 12th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you are doing great and have been having a great week. I know we're in some crazy, weird times, but I hope you are happy, healthy, staying safe, staying sane, all of the above. And if not, hopefully things are going to turn around and get better. And hopefully this show does a little bit to help out, maybe get you some time away to escape, whether you're out walking or just at home needing a little entertainment. I'm hoping to bring that to you. That's what we're hoping to do. I know it's really weird. I've been working at home for the past month. It's kind of like going back to when I was working for myself, not at the day job. So it's not too bad a transition for me, but I know it can be difficult for some folks out there. So, you know, if you need to reach out, you need to talk, you know, the MacCast lines are always open. You're welcome to reach out to me on social media, MacCast@gmail.com, whatever you want. But looking at the news and information that's going on in the Apple and Mac community this week, wow, we've got a lot of stuff happening, believe it or not. Some really interesting stuff. New acquisition by Apple into some VR tech. We're going to talk about that. What's going to happen with the next Mac update? Looks like we might be getting another MacBook Pro sometime soon. Also, Apple is planning a streaming event that's going to be available to everyone, a little bit of entertainment while we're at home. Also, we've got rumors about some things coming to iOS 14, possible new headphones from Apple, new iPad Pro information. Also, teens are still finding the iPhone to be one of their most popular devices. We have some numbers that go in to back that up. And when are we going to see that iPhone SE update? Might be sooner than you think. All of that in the news, and then I want to talk to you about a little warning about some iOS apps you might want to watch out for. I'm going to bring up some of the games that I am currently playing and enjoying on Apple Arcade. I want to share with you some of the stuff that I'm doing to pass the time, and hopefully you'll have some of your own recommendations for our community. And then I have a great question about two-factor authentication, and we'll wrap things up with a thing of the moment. Yeah, I got a new product this week that I've been using and really enjoying. Something is a little more on the practical side. We're going to get into all of that in this MacCast, so it should be a good one. Hang in there, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that show sponsor is Cashfly, and they are a great service. We love them. We rely on them to get this show out to you. You would not be hearing this show right now if it wasn't for Cashfly. They make sure my episodes get out quickly and reliably, and they want to do that for your website and your business. And that's because when sites don't load, people lose interest. You need to have a fast site in this day and age, especially on mobile. They know for a fact that for every second it takes to load a page, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. So you lose 16% of that audience the longer they wait. And fewer visits means fewer customers, not good for anyone. Well, good news is that Cashfly has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of Cashfly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond that of any traditional CDN. Cashfly's web content optimization solution includes a bunch of stuff: powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and fast asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know that it is, you can optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using. The good people at Cashfly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. You can know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how Cashfly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Just visit mac.cashfly.com, that's mac.cachefly.com right now for that free report, and a big thank you to Cashfly for their support of the podcast. Looks like Apple is continuing to make acquisitions in the augmented reality, virtual reality space. This week, according to 9to5Mac, Apple might be in the process of acquiring a company called NextVR. This firm actually has deals in place already with the NBA, Fox Sports, Wimbledon, and other live music and sporting event partners. And that's because what they do is produce VR content for live event viewing experiences, and they're working with all of the major VR headsets right now. The company actually holds over 40 different technology patents, and one of the reasons Apple might be interested in them might not even just be the VR stuff, because apparently one of the patent applications includes technology for upscaling video streams. Obviously, Apple with a big TV service and other technologies around video might be interested in that as well. So the deal is estimated at around $100 million, and Apple is thought to be hiring most of the engineers who have been developing the product. So it's an interesting little acquisition. You know, I think a lot of it is about the patents. A lot about of it is about the engineering talent. The production of the VR experiences for live events and concerts, that might even have some interesting applications inside some of the stuff that Apple's doing with Apple Music and trying to expand content and services there. Also might play into future technologies, future stuff that they might be wanting to do with the Apple TV Plus service. We haven't talked too much about VR video entertainment. I don't think that space has really taken off yet, but if Apple is planning some new hardware, augmented reality, virtual reality glasses, this could be some strategic acquisition that would play very nicely into that as well. I've messed around with this stuff a little bit. I think some folks have played around with it. I think, again, it hasn't really taken off yet, but those experiences are coming. So I think this is a play in the immediate future for some of the patent technologies and engineering talent, but might have some longer-term ramifications for Apple in their entertainment and music services as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out. We have the 16-inch MacBook Pro that came out recently. Awesome update. A lot of people in our community have been picking up that model. I've heard some great feedback from some of you on that. More recently, we just got a MacBook Air update that looks amazing. Again, both of these models getting that new scissor switch keyboard design. And guess what speculators think is going to be next for the MacBook Pro and updates? If you said 13-inch MacBook Pro, you would be right. We're hearing that the 13-inch MacBook Pro is going to get that scissor keyboard treatment next and could even get a bump up slightly in the screen size. The source for this one is YouTuber and leaker John Prosser, and he says that Apple is getting ready to put out a new model very soon. The latest rumors say the next version could come with a 14-inch display along with updated 10th generation Intel Ice Lake processors. In past reports, you may remember that Ming-Chi Kuo mentioned the possibility of a 14.1-inch mini LED display coming to a Mac model in 2020. That could be this MacBook Pro 13-inch update, and it would represent the first mini LED display. So that could be very cool, although this latest leak from John Prosser doesn't seem to mention the LED part, just simply the larger 14.1-inch display. And it is expected that the bezels might be a little bit thinner, so it could retain the same form factor as the current 13-inch model. The belief is we could see Apple announce the updated model as early as next month, so maybe a May release for this. So if you've been in the market for a new 13-inch MacBook Pro, you might want to hold off a little bit before making any purchase. Apple releasing new Macs, all of these new MacBook Pro models could be really good for them right now because they could need a little bit of a boost, at least if the latest numbers from Canalysis are any indication. For the first quarter of 2020, they looked at PC shipments and not surprising, they are down. But even worse is that Apple has taken a pretty big hit compared with the rest of the market, almost double the drop in sales over other PC manufacturers. The latest numbers from Canalysis for the first quarter of 2020 show that PC shipments are down 8% year over year, with an estimated 53.7 million units shipped. For Apple, they estimate that Apple shipped just 3.2 million Macs in the first quarter of 2020. That's down 20% from the 4.07 million Macs that they shipped in the first quarter of 2019. So Mac sales at the beginning of the year, not so hot for Apple, but they do have a lot of hot new models out. You would have thought the 16-inch MacBook Pro might have bumped things up a little bit more than that, but maybe with the current economic situation, you know, consumers are a little leery to upgrade that MacBook Air at that nice sub $1,000 starting price point with some nice spec bumps. It's probably going to help with those numbers. And if they can bring in that 13-inch MacBook Pro, I think that would help as well. It'd also be nice to see some updates to the iMacs. A lot of opportunities for Apple to turn those numbers around. So I'm not too concerned about it at this point, but interesting nonetheless. Here's a little positive news coming out of our current situation with COVID-19. Apple and others are teaming up to stream the One World Together at Home benefit. This is something being put together by Global Citizen and the World Health Organization. They've teamed up with Lady Gaga for a special benefit to support the fight against COVID-19. The benefit will be broadcast on Saturday, April 18th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, and it's going to be on just about every channel and service you can think of, ABC, NBC, and CBS. Plus, it's going to be streamed by Apple, Amazon Prime Video, Alibaba, Facebook, Instagram, Live X Live, Tencent Music Entertainment Group, Tidal, TuneIn, Twitch, Twitter, Yahoo, and YouTube. Yeah, this is going to be a very big thing. You cannot miss it. In addition to Lady Gaga, other artists are going to make an appearance. Billie Eilish, Elton John, Eddie Vedder, Paul McCartney, Stevie Wonder, and many others. And the event is being hosted by Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, and Stephen Colbert. So it should be very entertaining, very funny, all set up to support all the folks out there who are working hard to keep us safe and secure through this outbreak. Apple, as a matter of fact, also made a $10 million donation to the cause. So they are big, big supporters. So that should be a fun thing to look forward to next weekend. Again, Saturday, April 18th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern time. We're not really sure how Apple is going to distribute it, but I think it's a good guess that it'll be showing up on the Apple TV Plus service, or Apple inside the Apple TV app, more likely. Speaking of Apple TV Plus, this week they also made a bunch of their popular TV shows available to stream completely free without the need for an Apple TV Plus subscription. So if you want a little bit of entertainment from Apple, you can get that for free. You don't even have to sign up or subscribe. Nothing required. Just open up the TV app and you should have access to shows like The Elephant Queen, their documentary movie, Little America, Servant, I guess, and Dickinson, and For All Mankind. And if you're looking for family-friendly shows, they're also offering up all of the episodes of Helpsters, Ghost Rider, and Snoopy in Space. I personally really recommend For All Mankind and Dickinson, two of my favorite Apple TV Plus shows so far. I also really enjoy am enjoying Amazing Stories. I think it's a great reboot of that franchise. Unfortunately, it's not part of that free stuff, but you can sign up for your free trial if you haven't done that yet, and also get access to a bunch of other great content. In addition, Apple is opening up some other content, or Apple and their partners. Epic's movie channel right now is totally free, so that's a channel available on Apple TV Plus that you can check out. You can get in without a subscription, without having to sign up for anything. And also, some of the other channels, HBO, Hulu, and a few others are also offering up some of their content and TV shows. Right now, I'm watching the McMillions documentary on HBO, and I'm really enjoying that as well. So a lot of great entertainment and content being made available for free right now that you can take advantage of. Apple also might be picking up a new film project from Martin Scorsese for Apple TV. He had been working on a film starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro called Killers of the Flower Moon. It's based on a book by the same name. The project is with Paramount right now, but it's rumored to be costing more than $200 million, and Paramount is thinking that's a little bit too pricey, and looking like they're wanting out. So Martin Scorsese has been shopping around and is rumored to be in talks with both Apple and Netflix at possibly picking up the film. Part of the deal would mean that they would have to compensate Paramount for resources that they've already invested in the project. And it could be possible that one way the deal works out is that Apple works with Paramount to see the film to completion, with Apple picking up the costs, but then Paramount handling the theatrical release of the film, which would then come exclusively to Apple TV Plus after a theatrical release. And that's been kind of a big deal in doing these deals. And I guess right now, Netflix has been more interested in having stuff just on their streaming service and hasn't been working with artists and directors as much on getting a theatrical film release. And that tends to be very important, especially for big name directors and things like that, because they want to be eligible for the Oscars. And you do have to have, and for the awards shows, and in many cases, you need to have a theatrical release for that. Apple's been a little more amicable to that. So it's sounding like Apple has good chance at possibly picking up this Scorsese film, which would be a lot of good exposure for the Apple TV Plus service. So we'll have to keep an eye on this one and see if this deal works out for Apple. Oftentimes they lose out in the bidding war, but Apple has some pretty solid coffers right now and seems very focused on bolstering up their services offering and drawing in more consumers. And a Martin Scorsese film on Apple TV Plus could do just that. So are you ready for widgets on your home screen in iOS? This is a feature that a lot of people have wanted for a very long time. Now, on iPadOS, we did get widgets on the home screen, but now it's looking like this feature might be coming to iOS, at least if a Twitter leak is to be believed. So take this with a grain of salt, but a leaker on Twitter showed an image of what looks like the home screen of an iPhone showing widgets. The widgets would take up the space of two or four icons on the home screen, and it looks like the widgets would be able to be positioned on the screen. They just like icons, I would imagine you do the whole wiggle thing and move them around. It looks like they can also not only be on the home screen, but any app launcher screen, so you can have multiple widgets in different places, which is also an interesting concept. So they wouldn't all just be limited to the main screen. The same image also seems to indicate that we might be getting a little bit of a design change with the iPhone 12, because it shows about a 1/3 smaller notch at the top of the screen. Now, this whole thing looks to be a simple line art drawing, maybe a schematic, supposedly from some design documents, internal design documents from Apple. Again, take it all with a grain of salt, but it's interesting to think about. There's also another image supposedly showing the backside of the camera, indicating the presence of a LiDAR sensor on their rear-facing cameras, something that we already kind of speculated would be happening because of the LiDAR system being added in to the recent iPad Pro update. So, interesting to think about. I've never really been a huge widget person. I turned it on for my iPad Pro, and I do have them on the home screen, but I don't really access that information a lot. We do have a lot of options when it comes to widgets and choices, so I'd be curious to hear from you in the community. What are your thoughts on widgets? Are you using them? Do you use them a lot? Do you not use them because they're kind of hidden off, you know, the home screen on most of your devices? Maybe if they were surfaced like this and could be on the main home screen on your iPhone, would you use them more? How are you using widgets? I have a lot of questions about this. I kind of like widgets in some cases, but I often forget about them and don't seem to use them all that frequently. And so maybe that's just my own use case. So maybe you can help me out. You know, what's a great way to use widgets? What are some of the great ways you are using widgets on your devices? Let us know. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Also, on the iOS side of things, it looks like Apple released another quick update to iOS and iPadOS, 13.4.1. Now, they have released 13.4 earlier, which brought a welcome feature to the Files application that would be iCloud sharing, something we'd been waiting for a while, along with some other features and enhancements. The 13.4.1 update was released because it turned out there was a FaceTime bug in 13.4 that apparently affected people trying to make FaceTime calls with older devices running iOS 9 or earlier, or macOS 10.11 El Capitan or earlier. The update also fixed a bug in settings that could cause choosing Bluetooth from the quick actions menu on the home screen to fail. And then on the iPad OS side, there was also a fix for the flashlight not turning on from the lock screen on the new 2020 iPad Pro models. In addition, there was also a watchOS 6.2.1 update that also addressed a FaceTime bug, this time a FaceTime audio bug. The same source that brought us the updated 13-inch MacBook Pro rumors I talked about earlier in the show is also claiming that we could see new Apple-branded over-the-ear headphones at the Worldwide Developer Conference. To be honest, the rumor is not really new. We've talked about it here several times on the podcast. It's been floating around for a while. What is new is the possible release date. This latest leak claims that the headphones are codenamed B515 and that they'd be priced around US $350 and could be showing up in the next month or so. 9to5 Mac had also noticed a new headphone icon in the builds of iOS 14 that also seems to support that the fact that Apple could be getting set to release some over-the-ear headphones. The leaker also claimed in his tweet that the end goal of all of this was to phase out Apple's Beats line. This is where the rumor to me goes a little bit south, because it seems unlikely that Apple would want to get rid of the Beats brand because it is so well established and it has such a strong marketing presence. It seems like a really bad move. I imagine they're going to continue to keep both lines going, although it does kind of bring a little bit of brand confusion. If Apple can just keep the sort of crossover between the two brands separate and give them each some distinct and unique features, I think they could continue both. But, you know, the idea that they would sort of merge the brands together, I think that's going to be a slow, drawn-out thing if Apple does it all. Because, again, culturally, Beats, I think, in at least the music headphone space and with all of their celebrity endorsements in sports and in the music industry, that's just too strong a thing, I think, for Apple to let go. Still, he says that Apple is also planning a set of AirPods X priced around US $200, and that this would be a set of sports running AirPods similar to the Beats X design and coming in the fall right around the iPhone 12 launch. So that would again support this idea that maybe Apple is thinking about phasing out the Beats brand in favor of their own Apple-branded lineup. So what do you think about all that? Is it time for Apple to phase out Beats and make all of their headphone accessories under the Apple brand? Or should they continue both lineups or just continue with the Beats brand anywhere outside of AirPods? I kind of think the last tactic is the way to go. You know, even if Apple is bringing out a new over-the-ear headphone, having Apple-branded stuff marketed under the AirPods brand and keeping the Beats brand, I think, is the better way to go. But I'd love to hear your opinion. Shoot me an email. Send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And speaking of AirPods, Apple has seemingly had a little bit of a faux pas with sending out replacement AirPods. We heard this week that Apple has been sending out AirPods replacements with a newer-than-released firmware, 2D3. This seems to be happening with the AirPod 2 replacements a little bit more than some of the other AirPods, but we have heard reports that maybe some AirPod Pros have also suffered from this. And interestingly, it also seems to be that it's more often with a right earbud replacement than a left earbud replacement. So Apple has gotten ahead of itself a little bit. Unfortunately, they're telling affected customers that the only thing they can do is wait for Apple to update the firmware for it to be officially released for their replacement earbuds to start working again. Not really what you want to hear, but seems to be the case with the current situation. Of course, they don't know when or won't tell anybody when that firmware update is going to be officially released, so I would imagine it's a bit frustrating. I don't know if anybody in our community has been impacted by this, but if you have and you want to get it off your chest or you'd like to let us know your experience, I welcome your comments. It's official, the 2020 iPad Pro models do not have Apple's ultra-wideband U1 chip, or at least not one that iFixit could find in their teardown. They didn't even find antennas related to it either. And their findings were backed up by John Gruber, who also double-checked with his sources, who would be in the know, and they say that there is no U1 chip in there either. This is all not surprising given the fact that the U1 chip is not even mentioned in the tech specs for the iPad Pro. It's not in Apple's press release, nor are there any signs or references in the software that would support the fact of a U1 chip being in there. Still, given all the rumors of products like AirTags, Apple's new or rumored device tracking tags, and the fact that all iPhone 11 models do feature the ultra-wideband chip, it does seem a little bit odd that it wouldn't be there in the iPad. In iFixit's teardown, they note that the inside of the 2020 model looks nearly identical to the 2018 version, including using the same logic board layout. They speculate that if there was a U1 in there, the design would need to be different. We also discussed last time on the show that the A12Z processor seems to be exactly the same processor as the A12X with just an extra CPU core activated, one core that was deactivated in the A12X. So not even really a different processor, just different capabilities turned on. So it is possible that a U1 supported iPad Pro model could come out later when Apple bumps up the CPU to an A13X chip. That may happen sooner than later. Another possible reason for the absence of the U1 in the iPad is its all-aluminum enclosure, making antenna designs and radio transparency really less practical in that model versus the mostly all-glass iPhone design that they brought the chip to with the iPhone 11s. There are still some, though, who believe that Apple could do a new iPad Pro refresh in the fall, bringing the A13X chip and mini LED displays to the lineup. That could be when we see the U1 support added in. And I'm really not sure how I feel about Apple doing two iPad Pro updates in the same year. I would imagine that there's a lot of folks who are jumping into the iPad Pro right now, the 2020 version, and if they find out in the fall that there's a brand new version with a better processor and U1 support, that might be enough to upset a few customers. What do you think about that? Do you think Apple doing multiple iPad releases is a good thing, trying to stay ahead of the curve on the technology? I think from a business perspective, it probably is, but I'm not really sure how consumers would react to that. I'd love to hear your opinions on this one. Send me some feedback. Also on the iPad side of things, it looks like the Amazon UK store may have tipped the release date for Apple's new iPad Pro Magic keyboards. Apple hasn't really told us when they're coming out. They just have said they have them and that they're coming soon. If you go on the App Store right now, they are not available for purchase. They are not available for pre-order, but apparently Amazon's UK store, at least briefly, I don't know if they're still available, made the iPad Pro Magic keyboards available for pre-order, and they stated that the new accessory would have a release date of May 30th. So we don't know if that's the official date, but it could possibly be based on this post on Amazon UK. Looks like the iPhone is more popular with U.S. teens than it ever has been before. The investment firm Piper Sandler runs a long-standing semi-annual survey of U.S. teens and their smartphone preferences. Apple has been at the top of that survey list for a number of years, being the most popular device among U.S. teens, and now that popularity has grown even more. The recent numbers show that 85% of U.S. teens own an iPhone, and that 88% expect an iPhone to be the next phone that they buy. The survey also asked about AirPods usage. 52% of teens say that they own a set of AirPods, and of those that don't own AirPods, 18% said they plan to purchase them within a year. The study also looked at Apple Watch ownership among teens and found that 25% of U.S. teens said they owned an Apple Watch. That number was up 20% from the survey numbers that they did last fall. Now, it is worth noting that the survey is skewed toward teens with slightly more spending money. The survey included 5,200 respondents with self-reported spending of about $2,300 per year and an average household income of $65,000 a year. Outside of the iPhone's popularity with teens, it also looks like iOS in the U.S. is also showing a lot of activations in the first quarter of 2020. As a matter of fact, even more activations than Apple has ever seen since 2016, according to a new Consumer Intelligence Research Partners report. According to their numbers, iOS accounted for 44% of U.S. smartphone activations in the first quarter of 2020. And again, that is the highest numbers that Apple has seen in years. The report didn't really speculate on why the numbers seem to be increasing. I would imagine some of that due to the popularity of some more affordable iPhone models that we've talked about here on the show, like the iPhone 11, iPhone 8, and maybe some of the offers that have been going around. And with iPhone numbers having been sort of slowing or declining in past years, this is a little bit of good news for Apple and the iPhone market. And then finally in the news for this week, while we are still hearing reports that the iPhone 12 launch could be in jeopardy of being pushed out a little bit, the rumors of an iPhone SE update happening pretty soon remain fairly strong. The latest is that the next iPhone could be here in the next few weeks, We're expecting the update to be a new version of the iPhone 8 with the SE branding. This is something we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. This is the model I had been calling the iPhone 8 SE 2 because it's supposedly the update to the SE 2, but in an iPhone 8 form factor and with an iPhone 8 design, meaning that it's going to retain the 4.7-inch display and the Touch ID home button, but then get updated with the latest A13 processor and 3 gigabytes of RAM, similar to the specs from the iPhone 11. Also, similarly to the iPhone 11, it's expected to get the new dual lens camera system with the new wide angle lens, and Apple will supposedly be offering more storage with options up to 256 gigabytes and a rumored starting price of around $399, the same original starting price point as the iPhone SE. So it's kind of this merging of those two models, unfortunately not retaining the 4-inch size that many people like with the iPhone SE. So it's going to get a little bit bigger, going to get cheaper, and be updated with the newest, latest, greatest processors and RAM, retaining some of the older technology. So it really is this kind of merging, and it is expected that we will see an announcement for that and a possible release date within the next couple weeks. As for the iPhone 12, the latest is that engineering verification testing has been extended until late April for the 5.4-inch model and the 6.1-inch models, and that testing has been extended to mid-May for the 6.7-inch Max model. So that means the release date of the larger 6.7-inch model could be later than that of the 5.4-inch and the 6.1-inch models when we get to the fall. So we could be looking again at a staggered release with the smaller versions and the lower-cost versions coming out first, followed by the larger Max version later. Now, the good news is that according to Ming-Chi Kuo, Apple's 12-inch models will feature some of the latest and greatest wireless and other technologies. He says that they will all feature the Qualcomm X55 5G modem chip, offering a theoretical maximum throughput of 7 gigabits per second peak download speeds and 3 gigabits per second peak upload speeds, all while supporting both the millimeter wave and sub 6 gigahertz networks. So it's going to have all the latest and greatest 5G in there. It's also a possibility that we could see OLED displays with new ProMotion, something that we haven't seen in an iPhone yet. And as mentioned before, it is expected they're going to get the 3D LiDAR camera scanning system that Apple introduced in this year's iPad Pros. So the iPhone 12's looking to be a great update, expected out in the fall. But again, we might have this staggered release with a September, October, November time frame, depending upon what happens in the world. And I think that's reasonable to expect. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that sponsor is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to get a server and you're looking to deploy it quickly and easily, look no further than Linode. Linode makes it really easy to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and 10 node locations. They just opened their newest data center in Mumbai, India, and it's built using their most up-to-date hardware, next-generation network backbone, and allows you to comply with in-country data protection requirements, all while taking advantage of Linode's great technologies and tools. And best of all, they're giving new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And it certainly is more than hosting. This is a server. With Linode, you get all of the options and choices to build a server with the services and features you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration, and continuous delivery environments. It's all possible and all featuring SSD native storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers with simple pricing, no surprise fees. You pay just for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and their add-on services. And their new Cloud Manager is amazing. It's got an improved user interface. It makes it so easy to manage all of your Linodes and do anything you want with your configuration, upgrading pricing, adding on features. It is all quick and simple. Really great stuff. Just visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com, linode.com/maccast. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the show. So there's a few different kinds of not so nice software out there, and we have various terms for this stuff, right? There's malware. There is spyware. There is bloatware. And believe it or not, now it looks like we have a new one, especially on iOS, called fleeceware. This is a new term drummed up by the folks over at Sophos. They're actually a really great security firm, and they did a little analysis of apps on the iOS App Store, and they found 32 apps that they are calling fleeceware. And so I thought this was a good opportunity for me to introduce the term to you, because I wasn't really familiar with it, and talk about how you might be able to protect yourself and your friends and family from this stuff. These are all legitimate apps. They've gone through Apple's app review process. I'm sure Apple is going to maybe develop some new rules and restrictions around these, but right now there are 32 of them on the App Store. Not too many, right? This is not a large, if you think of the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of apps that are on the App Store at this point, 32 of these things isn't too bad, but they are apps that people might run across. And the apps are found across a bunch of different categories. They're in things like image editors, QR code scanners, face filter apps, horoscope apps. There's a bunch of them. And the one thing that they all have in common that ends up making them be called fleeceware is that they have really bad or expensive in-app subscription options. So they come through as quote-unquote free apps with free trials, but then they try and trick customers into signing up for these expensive in-app subscriptions, basically fleecing you of your money when you're not looking. And they often will use misleading or confusing pop-ups or language to try and get you to sign up for these subscriptions. A lot of them have really short initial trial periods. This is a sign that it might be fleeceware if they're only giving you a 3-day free trial or a couple days instead of the usual 7 days or 30 days. That's a red flag that should be going up in your mind. Another thing is that they will often have their subscription, the default subscription, be a weekly subscription. So you might think that you're paying a monthly price, but what you're doing is paying that price every week. And as you might imagine, that adds up very quickly. To add to the confusion, they also tend to offer a monthly option and a yearly option, and almost always the yearly option is the most affordable option, but they don't show you that up front, right? They show you this weekly price. And I say affordable for the yearly option in air quotes that you can't see me doing because it's an audio podcast, but air quotes affordable because the typical annual subscription costs on these fall around the $50 to $100 a year price range. So not exorbitant if you're talking about a really useful utility, but a lot of these are little kitschy apps, again, like little horoscope apps, or they don't do a lot, right? They don't bring a lot of functionality. $100 a year for something like that, or $80 a year for something like that, might not be something that you really feel is worth the money. And believe me, the monthly prices or the weekly prices that they're charging you on these things, you're talking about $7, $8, $9, $10 a week. So up to like $40, $50 a month if you end up on these weekly subscription plans. So starting to get the picture why these things are being called fleeceware. Yeah, they're pretty nasty things. Now, luckily, Apple has made it pretty easy to go in and check the status and the costs on your subscriptions and in-app subscriptions in iTunes over the past few releases. In the latest version of iOS, it's really easy. You go into the settings, so open up the settings app, tap on your name at the top, tap on subscriptions, and that will bring up all of your subscriptions, both the stuff that is active and the stuff that has been expired. You can go through, you can see the renewal dates, you can see how much you're paying for that subscription. You can also see the frequency of that subscription. And again, these Fleeceware ones are weekly, so look out for that. You can scroll through, you can tap on a subscription to get the details, and then you can go in, you can renew, you can change the terms there, you can resubscribe, you can even cancel the subscription. If you've fallen into one of these Fleeceware apps, or maybe one of your family members has, you're going to want to do that cancel option. Also, you might try contacting Apple support and let them know what happened. Very often, Apple support will side with the consumer more than the developer. It's actually something they get a little bit of flack for, but in this case, it's actually going to be a really good thing. And like I said, I have a feeling that now that these are surfacing, Apple's going to be looking into and reviewing these things a little bit more closely. But technically, these apps aren't violating any of the terms. They're kind of following the rules, but they're kind of weaseling their way in there. So, you know, these are scammy, weaselly developers. We don't really want to support them, and hopefully Apple will be cleaning this stuff up. But at the very least, here in the community, we can make you aware of what's going on. We can educate you, and you can hopefully take this information and knowledge and go educate your friends and family members so that people don't fall victim to these scams. So that's what Fleeceware is all about. Again, just another one of the wares that we have to now look out for. Let's go on to something a little bit more fun. I wanted to talk to you again because some of us, you know, we're stuck at home. We're maybe not going out as much as we can, and we're needing to pass some time. And, you know, I talked about a number of Apple-y ways on a previous podcast that you could pass time, and maybe some not so Apple-y ones, including playing some board games, one of my favorite pastimes. I've asked for some of your feedback. I haven't heard from too many people on this topic, but I did this week think, hey, I'm in playing some new games on Apple Arcade. And I think Apple Arcade is a great value overall. About $5 a month if you are into casual games, if you're into games at all. It is a great way to go, and I don't think it's too expensive. You can also get some discounts if you pay for a year up front. I am really enjoying my Apple Arcade subscription, and I thought I'd talk about some titles that I have been playing recently. One that I've been hearing about for a while and just never got into is Butter Royale. It is a Battle Royale style game. And oh my gosh, this thing is a ton of fun. I've been playing with my daughter. We've been kind of teaming up and going through it, and it is really neat. Now, you do need to have a controller for this. We play on the Apple TV. She plays on the Apple TV. I play on my iPad. That's still a little bit of a point of contention for me with a lot of these multiplayer games. They're multiplayer, but through iCloud. So you can't have two people on the same Apple TV. Each person has to kind of be on their own device. But you do need a controller for it. I have a Nimbus Steel Series controller that I absolutely love. I also recently bought a PS4 controller. I think you can also use an Xbox controller. Basically anything you can connect with, or PlayStation or Xbox controllers that you can connect with Bluetooth. And I think they need to be a little more modern. Like I said, I have a PlayStation 4 controller. It works great with both my iPad and my Apple TV. And Butter Royale is basically a 30-player battle royale style game, like Fortnite, but a lot less serious, a lot less competitive. The whole theme is kind of a food fight sort of theme. You've got different guns and weapons that are squirting things like mayonnaise or ketchup, and you're trying to outrun this circle of butter that is slowly closing in on you and pushing you towards the center. So it's your classic battle royale scenario. You have a couple different game modes that you can play. If you don't want to play online, there's an offline mode where you can just play against the computer AI. There's a solo mode, so if you don't want to form up a squad or a team, you can play in solo mode, one-on-one. And also there is a squad mode. That's what we've been playing mostly. It's a team of four. If you don't have four players, it will fill in with other players from the online mode. So you get additional players on your team. And just like most Battle Royale games, you have a map, you pick a starting zone to start in, and then once the game launches, you're running around, you're gathering weapons, armor, ammo, you're trying to build up your character and your weapons and defenses. In this one, there's no building element like in Fortnite, so it is just the fighting and gathering of resources and stuff like that. They do have game drops with bigger weapons and more powerful weapons that you can get. And then, like I said, the circle of butter, flowing butter, sort of flows in. You're running away from that toward the middle, pushing all the players toward that central area where you have that big battle royale to the finish. It's got some really great power-ups, and you can earn money and things like that. Again, because it's an Apple Arcade game, it's awesome. No in-app purchases. You can't spend any real money on this outside your subscription costs. And the games are really quick. They don't take very long, just probably 5-10 minutes per game. And you can earn loot and rewards. You get new skins and flags and footprints, additional melee weapons and stuff like that, so you can customize out your character. And we've just been having a ton of fun playing this. I'm even kind of thinking it'd be fun to maybe get a little squad of MacCast people together if we could at some time. I don't know how we'd coordinate that, because you kind of have to get this code that comes up on screen and share it, but if we can figure something out, if you have some ideas, I'd be open for that sort of thing. Another Apple Arcade game that I started getting into recently is Oceanhorn 2. This is a great RPG-style game. It is set up for solo play. I think you do have to have a game controller. I'm preferring to play it on my Apple TV. It kind of has this great, fun, pirate, seafarer-type theme with a sci-fi twist. I'm only maybe about 10-12% into it, and it is very big, very immersive. It's got a great combat system. You have a sword, you have guns, you can kind of power things up. You go around collecting objects. It's got all these great creatures. It is a 3D full immersive environment. It has a lot of puzzle elements to it, all of those typical RPG style elements. So you go on little missions, you have to make little achievements to kind of progress in the game. It's got really nice save point locations, so you're not feeling like you're falling back and losing a bunch of time when you're playing it, and you can kind of come in and out of it, and it's just visually gorgeous. It's got a lot of great, really great environments, a great sort of anime cartoon style look to it, and like I said, it's all pirate seafarer kind of themed. You've got these islands, and then they throw in these sci-fi kind of elements on top of it. So it's very interesting, a lot of fun. I had heard a lot about Oceanhorn. I never played the original. I've just started playing Oceanhorn 2, and it's working out fine for me. I don't think I've missed anything, but there's probably some backstory that I don't really understand. But again, a great game, and it's available with your Apple Arcade subscription. So I'm really enjoying playing that one. And like I said, there are so many titles on Apple Arcade. It's hard to get into all of them. Every single one of them that I've played, and I think this is an important thing to point out about that subscription service, is there hasn't been a single title that I've downloaded that I've said, this isn't a quality title. The amount of curation that Apple has done on that, picking the developers that are on the platform and who they're working with, they have done an excellent job with that. Every game on there is quality, and what I really appreciate, like I said earlier, is no in-app purchase, no extra, you know, trying to get money out of you. You just download the games, you play them. Another one that I started playing recently is one called Spider. It's kind of a spy-themed game where you're this little metallic robotic spider roaming around, and again, it's a puzzle-style game, but really great 3D environments, and I just started that one today, so I'm not too deep into it, so I didn't really include it on this list, but I'll give it to you as another bonus one. I'm sure you have some picks of your own. If you want to share those with me and send in an audio comment, that would be great, a little 3-minute review of some of your favorite Apple arcade games, shoot those to us. Send me audio comments, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll try and share those out with the rest of the community on a future episode. And if you want to just chime in on a great iOS game, maybe something that isn't even part of Apple Arcade, in case you're not an Apple Arcade subscriber, share those as well. I look forward to hearing from you. All right, I did receive a little question this week, actually a series of questions from listener Graham. He was wondering about two-factor authentication, or rather, he was starting to activate two-factor authentication on his accounts, but he had some questions about it. And so here's what Graham is wondering about.
Hi, Adam. This is listener Graham from Portland, Oregon. I've been doing a lot of hard work on upping my password security lately, and I've done a deep dive into two-factor authentication. I think I understand the basics, but I'm trying to think ahead to situations where I might get tripped up. Now, I'm using the Google Authenticator app, but what I wonder about is what happens if I lose my phone? I know that a lot of sites provide backup codes, but are there other ways that I can get in that are easier? Can I set up authentication on two different devices? So if I lose one, I can still get the correct code from the other device. Now, I know that password programs like 1Password also have two-factor authentication generators. If I change from Google Authenticator to 1Password, let's say, do I need to turn off two-factor authentication for all my devices on the site, or is there an easier way to make the switch from one authenticator program to another? What I'm hoping is that you'll be able to give all of us your best advice on how to be prepared if you lose your phone while using two-factor authentication. Thanks again for the show, Adam. I never miss it.
Hey, Graham. Thank you for being a longtime supporter and longtime listener and contributor to the show. I really appreciate this message. I think you're probably not alone in a lot of these questions that you have. I'll try to answer these questions kind of in the order that you gave them in your audio comment there. I think the first thing that we talked about was the backup codes. You know, is there other options besides the backup codes to use in case you lose your devices and have no other way to get a two-factor code? And fortunately or unfortunately, I guess fortunately is probably the better way to go. The backup codes are going to be what you need if you've completely lost any kind of access to the two-factor option. So if you don't have any other devices set up, you only have the single device, you lose, or you lose all the devices, say, you know, something catastrophic happens, some sort of natural disaster, a fire, something like that, and you just lose all of your devices, backup codes are going to be something you need. And that's why I recommend always putting those two-factor backup codes into a password manager, something that syncs with the cloud, syncs with other devices like 1Password. I actually do it either as an attachment to the record in 1Password or right inside the notes for that record, or just even create a new custom field for those backup codes. However you want to do it, get it into a secure system. Some people will actually print them out and put them into a safe deposit box. Again, you're going to want them someplace that's off-site or on-site and off-site, however you want to do it, but you want to make sure you have that backup. So if you're using some sort of other off-site or cloud backup system, that could accomplish the same thing. They're really your last-ditch emergency effort, and that's why they're called emergency backup codes or what have you. Now, you can have the Authenticator app on multiple devices. I think that was the next thing you asked about. You know, can I set up these authentication codes on multiple devices? Yes, you can. Now, with the Authenticator app, it's a little bit trickier because you have to have some foresight. You can't have scanned it in to one device and then come back later and add another device, unfortunately. To do it on multiple devices, you're going to have to set up the same seed by scanning the same QR code at the same time on every device. So when you go in to set up the two-factor authentication, get all of your devices there ready to go. Make sure they have the Authenticator app on all the devices that you want to set up at the same time. And then when you turn on two-factor authentication, it presents that QR code. Scan it on all the devices at the same time. That way they will all have the same seed and they will all be generating the same codes. If you had not set this up originally, that means you are unfortunately going to have to go back, remove or disable two-factor authentication for that account, and then re-enable it to set up all of your devices. Now, this is one area where using a two-factor authentication scanner built into your password manager, if it's an option, which it is with 1Password, as you noted, is, in my opinion, a little bit better, because 1Password can actually sync all of your passwords via the cloud and also syncs all of your two-factor authentication setup across all your devices. So you don't need to have all your devices there when you set up two-factor authentication if you use the two-factor scanner built into the 1Password app. So I'll just scan it in 1Password, and because 1Password syncs to the cloud and syncs to all of my other devices, they all get that same two-factor seed, and that way they generate the same codes no matter what device I have. So it could be my iPad, it could be my Mac, it could be my iPhone. They're all going to give me that number that I need when I'm setting up the two-factor authentication. So that's a good thing. It's also worth noting that for Apple IDs and iClouds, when you set up for your Apple accounts two-factor authentication, all of your devices do get set up and included in that pool. So by default, you kind of get multiple devices if you have multiple devices registered with the same Apple ID or Apple account for two-factor authentication with Apple. And you have the added benefit of that any device that's participating in your two-factor authentication with iCloud, say, you can generate manually a code from any device should you need it. To do this, and we've covered this a few times on the show, but I'll cover it again, just open up Settings on your device, tap on your account name at the top of the settings, tap on Password and Security, and then you can tap Get Verification Code, and you'll get that standard pop-up that you normally get when Apple, you know, sends out a two-factor authentication request. So when you're trying to log in to iCloud, say, you know, it will alert you on your device and say, here's the code. You can pull that code up anytime on your device by using the manual method. And it would be just like launching the Authenticator app, but in this case, it's built right into your device. So that's another way to go. I think the third thing you asked about was changing from one Authenticator program to another. Just like when you're trying to set up multiple Google Authenticator apps with the same code, it is going to be the same process to switch from one to the other. There's no easy way to go about it. You are going to have to go log into that account, go into the security settings for that account, disable two-factor authentication for your old authenticator, re-enable it using the new authenticator to scan that QR code to get that new two-factor authentication seed. So I don't know of any like simple one-stop shop where you can do all of that. It's not built into the password managers. You do have to do it per account. And so I know that could be a little bit cumbersome, but you're probably going to have to do it that way. Just overall, you know, I'm going to say this whole concept of two-factor authentication and what happens if I lose my phone concern, it's a big one for a lot of folks. And so you're right to bring it up. It is a big concern. I think it's one of the biggest factors in a lot of people not adopting or using two-factor authentication because they think it's scary. But it really doesn't have to be a big deal if you just take the time like we are now to sort of understand how it works and understand that it's important to save those backup codes. I think the backup codes are really key because, again, if you lose any one device or all your devices, those backup codes are going to allow you to still get back into your account, change the settings, set up new devices, all that sort of things. As long as you have those, you're in a good place. And again, if you put them into your password manager and sync all that stuff, you are going to have that stuff. Just make sure they're stored in a good, secure location. And then add on top of that, some of the advice we gave here, setting up two-factor authentication support across multiple devices makes all of this stuff a little less scary. At least I would hope. Once you start getting used to two-factor authentication and using it more and more, you'll see it's ultimately a really good thing, and it is not that hard to manage or set up. It feels daunting at first, but it really is not too bad, and you get more comfortable with it over time. I do think a password manager application that has built-in support like 1Password really, really does help in this arena. Another thing to remember, and this is the last thing we'll close out with, is, you know, if you do lose your device, one of the devices that's participating in your two-factor authentication, you're going to want to make sure that you go in and remove that device from your accounts. So again, you're going to have to go back to all of your accounts. You're going to have to use your backup codes or an alternate device to log into the two-factor authentication. Go into the security settings and make sure you remove that device from participating in all of your two-factor authentication stuff. And this is when having all of that information, your passwords, your two-factor authentication backup codes, everything in a centralized single password manager like 1Password is really going to come in handy, right? So you want to remove all of your old devices. Same thing if you sell a device, right? If you sell a device or get rid of a device, give it to a new family member, you have to remember to go back into all of your accounts that it's registered with and remove that device from those accounts so that it's not attached to that anymore. I think that's almost a little bit more cumbersome. But again, if you have it all in a password manager, you can kind of go through and see where that is. You might even want to, in your password manager, tag which devices are logged in or set up to be authenticated through different accounts and that sort of thing. So just another thing that can make password managers a little bit more useful, right? So thank you for the question, Graham. This was a great one, and happy to be able to address it here on the MacCast, and I hope it helps you out. If you have any additional questions, you know how to find me, maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about today is a quick thing of the moment. This one's a little bit more utilitarian than fun, but if you have a Mac, you probably have a number of USB devices. And if you have a Mac notebook, you may or may not have enough ports. Even some of the desktop models, maybe you don't have enough ports. And so USB hubs are kind of a thing that a lot of us use. And I had this 10-port Satachi USB hub. I think it's a 2.0 version, so a little bit older. And it started to act up over the past couple weeks. I was having a little bit of issues. I played around with replacing cables and doing some standard troubleshooting, but I just decided, you know what? It's a little bit older. I have a lot more USB 3 devices these days. I probably am due for a little bit more modern one. And Anker is one of my favorite brands. And so I just did some searching on their website. This Satachi one, like I said, was a 10-port model, really 7 ports plus 3 charging ports. And I found something very similar on the Anker website, the Anker 10-port 60-watt data hub. It has 7 USB 3 ports and then 3 PowerIQ charging ports. And what's cool about the PowerIQ technology from Anker is it adapts those ports for the amperage depending upon how many things you have plugged in. So with the 3 charging ports, each one of them offers 2.1 amps per port, or you can get up to 10 amps overall. So you can do faster charging if you have a device that can use more amperage, or you can have more devices plugged in. It all depends upon what you need. So I have, like, just in the charging port, my wireless charging pad, also an Anker brand pad, by the way, for my iPhone plugged into those ports. And what I liked about this model is it has a nice, very compact size for the USB hub. The only disappointment when I got it, though, was the fact that the power supply for it is actually larger than the hub itself. There's probably really no way around that. You know, it is a 60-watt data hub, so it does have some nice power coming into it, which is a good thing. You're going to have a good powered USB hub, but it is kind of funny that the charging brick is even bigger than the actual device itself. It is model number A7515. That's specifically the one I've got. Anker has a bunch of different options for USB hubs, can probably meet all of your needs. And like I said, they're one of my favorite brands. They're very good, very reliable, affordable. This particular hub was about $43, $42.99 US on Amazon. And again, it's the Anker 10-port 60-watt data hub. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And it is my thing of the moment for this week. Well, with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. As always, I'd like to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, just simply MacCast on Instagram. As a matter of fact, you'll probably find me as MacCast just about every place on the internet. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.